So what are some things that create a haunted house or a haunted space?
Unsolved crimes.
Brutal murders.
Tragic accidents.
Different types of natural tragedies. I feel like anytime a child is killed, that's definitely
up there.
Yeah, exactly. So the house we're going to be talking about today is a simple little farmhouse in Villisca, Iowa. The story has more than its fair share of mysteries. It is an unsolved murder. There were children murdered in the house. And the house is still standing and has been fully restored, should you want to venture there. But it's definitely not for the faint of heart.
I would not want to.
Mm-mm. I'm Christina.
And I'm Kristen.
And this is the story of the Villisca Axe Murder House. Okay, before we jump in today, I just want to give you all a quick reminder that we are going to be at CT Horror Fest on Saturday, September 18th. Tickets are on sale now, so get them while they last. I am guessing that they have an open capacity, but I'm not sure, you know, how open it is. I know there's always a limited space every single year, so
get your
sure.
tickets now.
Exactly. I'm sure that's going to continue this year. And definitely be sure to swing by our table and see us, because we would love to see you, and we'll have some fun little swag stuff for you. A huge thank you to our newest Patreon member, Samantha. Thank Woo! You so much. Sam and I have known each other since we were in, like, fourth grade, I think.
Wow. And it's a long friendship.
Right? We did theater together. Crazy, right? You know, totally ludicrous that I would do something like that.
You?
I know.
Theater?
I know. And so, you know, we just really appreciate it. She's a huge supporter. She's always, like, commenting and, like, sending feedback. She's actually suggested a couple of things to us. You know, just as a reminder, this is something we do for fun. There's no profit in it for us right now. If you love what you hear, if you want to help, whether it's financially or just moral support, you know, check out our link tree, subscribe, follow the podcasts wherever you can, and wherever you listen, rate and recommend us. And thank you so much for listening. Now on to the Villisca Axe Murder House. Villisca, Iowa is a small rural town in Montgomery County, Iowa, which is in the southwestern part of the state. Are you kind of familiar or not really?
No.
Okay. So the current population is just over 1,200 people. And to kind of put it into perspective, the whole town is only about 2 square miles. So that's not a lot. That's like between your house and mine, basically. Yeah. That's if you imagine it.
That's not a town.
Exactly. Well, there it is. There it is.
It's really crazy.
And actually, when this story took place, there was a greater population than there is right now. Yeah.
So 2 people live in Villisca, Iowa.
No, a little over 1,200, or a little under 1,200 people.
In 2 square miles?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. And that's according to like the last census and stuff like that. It could have adjusted by now.
I feel like that's a lot of people for such a small space.
It might be. I'm trying to picture it. I mean, like 2 square miles. Like, it's probably a greater space than we're really thinking it is, sort of thing.
Either way. That's not a lot of people. Small town.
And to give you all a visual, so I pulled up like Google Maps of Villisca, Iowa, and the two things that, you know how like Google Maps will give you landmarks of like major grocery stores and like that kind of stuff? The two things showing as landmarks were the Villisca Axe Murder House.
Of course.
And a Casey's. Now, for anyone who's not from Iowa or has never lived in Iowa, Casey's is a general store. So think like a Cumbie's for us here in the Northeast, or like in the South, or
a Wawa.
A Wawa in New Jersey. Exactly. A Bucky's in Texas, or like a Sheetz down in Maryland. West Coasters, I have literally no idea what your general stores are called, so I can't even give you a visual, but I'm sure you are getting the idea at this point. So, you know, the reason why I'm making a point of this is because they show it as a landmark. So the town is so small that the gas station in town is a landmark, which is kind of crazy to me. If you Google Villisca, Iowa, everything has to do with this murder and this house. I mean, even the town page mentions it front and center. So it's basically become the identity of Villisca. It's almost as if time sort of stood still.
Stood still.
Exactly. It stood still for the town back in 1912. And everything just sort of stopped rolling forward.
I mean, it's a pretty big happening.
It is.
Especially for such a small town.
It is.
I can't imagine, like, what else they would be perseverating over.
I like perseverating. All right, cool. It's just one of those things where awful things happen all the time, you know? But with something like this...
This is pretty awful.
Don't get me wrong. This is horrendous. But it has overtaken the identity of the town. Prior to the incident, Villisca was a bustling but rural, you know, Iowa town. Sunday church was a whole town event. It was ripe with industry, community values. The Moore family was a prominent family in town. Josiah Moore, aged 43, sometimes referred to as Joe or JB, was a local business owner. He operated the very successful hardware store, the Moore Implement Company, which was apparently a John Deere franchise company, or company franchise rather. Like that store was affiliated with John Deere, which is a huge name brand recognition.
Especially in this town.
Well, and especially in Iowa. I mean, like, it's a big deal. It's the first time I ever heard of what a John Deere was. And John Deere's a big deal.
It is.
They make country songs about it.
It's literally. True. I know.
So his greatest competition in this very small town was the Jones store, which was owned and operated by his former employer, F.F. Jones. And when Moore, J.B. Moore, left the Jones store, he actually took the John Deere account with him.
Which is not cool.
No, definitely not.
But we'll get into that a little later.
Exactly. So JB's wife, Sarah Montgomery Moore, age 39 at the time that this occurred, she was very active in the Presbyterian Church. She regularly assisted with service activities and the children's mass activities. She actually had a lot to do with the planning of all of those. And that will come up within this. So together, the Moores raised four children: Herman, who was 11, Catherine, who was 10, Boyd, who was 7, and Paul, who was 5. On June 9th in 1912, the Moore family attended first morning services at their church. Catherine, the only Moore daughter, sought out her friends Lena and Ina Stillinger. Lena and Ina were there to attend morning services. They were then going to go off and visit their grandmother and then return to the church for the children's services at 8 p.m. Now, by children's services, it's almost like a children's showcase. So think about, like, you know, the end of a preschool. They do, like, little performances and art projects, and they mm-hmm. show everything off. That's essentially what this was. There were, like, some guest speakers and that kind of stuff coming in. So it was a showcase, you know, the children's services. And after that time, they were going to head back to their grandmother's and stay with her for the night. Now, keep in mind, the whole town is only 2 square miles. It was under 5 square kilometers. Instead, after this, after the children's activities, Catherine, in true 10-year-old girl fashion, exactly.
And everyone wants a sleepover.
Exactly. Asked if Lena and Ina could spend the night at the Moore house. So phone calls were made, everybody was made aware, and that's what happened. They stayed. All parties agreed. JB left a message with the Stillinger family to let them know where the children would be. And the major reason that they didn't want to walk home that night was actually because there was an ongoing dispute about who should generate the power for the streetlights. So they were off. And even though it was only a short walk, these are two little girls, and they're like, we don't want to walk home alone in the dark.
Right.
So they didn't, and they slept over at the Moore's house.
Probably should have walked home.
Oh my God, tell me about it. Like, when stuff like this happens, it's so much worse than it just happening, I swear. So according to the podcast Stuff You Missed in History Class on iHeartRadio, the two young girls were just terrified to walk back to their grandmother's house during the late evening. The Moores and the Sillinger girls returned back to the Moore home at 9:45 p.m., and then they all turned in for the night. So it wasn't a sleepover that we would necessarily think of.
Not as a 10-year-old and the... What,
they did not braid each other's hair.
1990s and 2000s.
Exactly. No. They did not braid each other's hair. They did not watch horror movies. They basically became a horror movie, which is so much worse.
not funny.
Pillow fights didn't happen, you know, none of that. Anyway.
Lights out by 9:45.
Exactly.
No, and
probably
actually,
like 10 o'clock, yeah.
Like asleep, though.
Asleep, exactly.
Not just lights out.
They went to bed. So the next morning, now remember, this is a Sunday, so the next morning is a Monday, yep. And everybody was supposed to go to school. The next morning, which was June 10th, 1912, at about 7 a.m., a neighbor, Mary Peckham, noticed that the Moore family home was oddly calm. You'd figure, you know, with four kids in a household, that there would be people out and about, they'd be tending to the animals, doing morning chores, you know, just making general ruckus and noise. It's a small town, people live close together, you'd think you'd hear it.
Right.
Absolutely nothing. So Mary Peckham decided to help out a little bit. She let out the Moore's chickens. But after a bit, she started to notice that there was still no sign of the family. No signs coming from the home. And
no sounds.
No. What did I say?
You said no signs.
Oh, yeah. No sounds coming from the home.
No signs either.
No signs either. Nothing was being launched from the house. So she decided to knock on the door. She found it locked. Now, today, that maybe wouldn't be as odd, but, so this is the Midwest.
Again, 1912, small town, everyone knows each other.
Exactly.
Probably
super
don't lock
rural,
their doors, ever.
Definitely not locking their doors. I don't even know what lock technology was at that point. You know, like, is it a latch lock? You just don't even know. Anyway. So she's like, oh, it's kind of weird. So Peckham fetched Josiah's brother, who lived nearby. His name was Ross Moore. Ross also found the door locked.
Sorry, did she think that he was going to find it unlocked after she found it locked?
So he also found the door locked, which he also...
He didn't have magic powers.
He did not. He did not. He did not use his laser vision to open the door. He heard no response when he banged on the door and shouted out. And he also kind of noticed that all of the windows were covered. And he's like, well, this is kind of weird. So he runs home, fetches his spare key, brings it back, unlocks the door. It didn't take long for Ross to discover an absolutely horrific scene.
Also, can we pause for a second?
Absolutely.
He had to run back to his house to fetch the key. He didn't bring it with him when the neighbor was like, hey,
the door's locked. It's weird.
He didn't grab the key then.
He was probably like, oh, Mary Peckham,
you're
old
an idiot.
And weak.
It's not locked.
It's not locked. I'll open it with my man brute strength. And no, clearly that was not what happened.
So anyway, he unlocked the door.
He gets the
after
key.
Running home to getting
exactly,
the key.
Exactly. So he walks into the home and he discovers just an absolutely horrific scene. I mean, no one could be prepared for this, but when it's your own family that you're discovering, I just think it's beyond.
Right.
So he entered the parlor and found the bludgeoned bodies of Lena and Ina Stillinger, the two little girls who
the
were there
sleepover
for the
girls.
Sleepover. Exactly. He immediately had Mary Peckham call for the peace officer, Henry Hank Horton.
Police. That's a police officer, but they called it
a peace officer. Basically, it was a member of law enforcement. They didn't have police because they really didn't have crimes like this on a regular basis.
They got police after this.
Yeah, so they were kind of just people who kept the peace. You know, if someone was getting a little unruly at the, I don't know, the stockyard.
At the church.
Exactly. At the church on Sunday afternoon. They, you know, maybe had a pint too many at the local bar. He kind of brought them down a little bit. I love his name, Henry Hank Horton. Like, that's a mouthful.
It is.
So when Hank arrived to the scene, he discovered the bodies of each member of the Moore family, as well as the already found bodies of the Stillinger girls. The weapon used had been J.B. Moore's own axe. In the attic of the Moore home, which to me, is more of, like, a large unfinished closet. So I know, like, here in on the East Coast and in Connecticut, we have a lot of, like, crawl space attics or, like, pull-down attics with, like, stairs. There mm-hmm. aren't a ton of walk-up attics. They may be more common in other places. This was basically, like, a large unfinished closet off of the primary bedroom, the master bedroom.
Actually, I looked at it. So it yeah. kind of looks like a linen closet without the shelving.
Right, exactly.
Maybe it's a little like, larger. It wasn't kind of open. It wasn't very big, though.
I mean, I guess it's like, larger than a regular closet.
And yeah. I'd be in there, I'd feel claustrophobic.
Claustrophobic, that makes sense. That makes sense. So, within there, they found two spent cigarette butts on the floor. It basically led authorities, or in some circumstances, to believe that the killer or killers waited for the Moores to return to the home and fall asleep, which kind of adds to the level of calculation that took place for this.
Right. This wasn't like a
spontaneous run in the room, kill everybody, and run out sort of thing.
It wasn't the devil took me
over. Right. It wasn't like
it was premeditated.
Exactly. Like, they knew what they were doing. They thought it out. You'll also see, too, there's signs that the killer stayed behind for quite a while afterwards, right. and a lot of other signs of bizarre activity.
We'll get to that again.
Oh, my God. And I am just going to go ahead and throw out a trigger warning, because we are going to go into a little bit of graphic detail of what occurred. So at this point, if this is already too much for you, I highly suggest skipping to the next
and
episode.
And there's an added of abuse. Elements of abuse as well.
Abuse and definitely like a negative sexual content and
that's
all of
what
that
I meant
too.
By abuse.
Yeah, sexual.
Sexual abuse. Yeah.
So yes, take your time. And the coroner of the town later determined that the murders had taken place sometime between midnight and I saw it two ways, either 5 a.m. or 3 a.m., but either way, in the early morning hours of June 10th, 1912.
Before the sun came up.
Exactly. So Josiah J.B. Moore was by far the most gruesome. The killer or killers had used the sharpened side of the axe and struck J.B. so many times with the axe blade that his eyes were actually missing.
That's really crazy and hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
So that makes me think that's rage.
Absolutely.
And not just like, I'm gonna kill my first person here.
Right, right. And, I mean, they actually come back to the parents. Like, they go off, they kill the children, and then they come back to the parents. And
still angry with the parents.
Exactly, exactly. So the Moore parents, they were the first to be murdered. They were also the only ones who had the actual axe blade used on them. The rest of the Moore family and the Stillinger girls were actually bludgeoned to death with the butt end of the axe blade, so the dull side. And it actually appeared that the killers began with the Moore parents, moved on to the Moore children, returned to inflict more pain on the Moore parents because they knocked over a shoe that had been sitting there during the first few strikes to the Moore parents. And by the time they returned, it had filled with blood and they knocked it over. And so they saw the spilled blood from the filled shoe. After that, they then proceeded downstairs to kill Lena and Ina, the family's guests for the day. So it's alleged that all of the family members were asleep when they were killed, as was Ina Stillinger. However, it's believed that at some point Lena was awakened by the commotion and tried to escape or fight back.
It's believed this because she was, of how her body was found.
Exactly. She was laying in an odd kind of crossways position on the bed and had defensive wounds on her arm. So, before I get into the next part, I'm just thinking, so these, and I talk about it a little bit later too, but they actually found dents in the ceiling from where the axe swung up and then swung back down.
Oh, dents.
Dents.
Like, it was divots like blood and stuff. Splatter.
There was blood splatter as well, but it was actually like they went up and they smacked the ceiling with the axe and then they brought it down.
Oh, yeah, the ceilings are quite low in farmhouses.
Exactly.
Especially in that time.
Exactly. And I'm thinking, too, there probably wasn't a tremendous amount of insulation. If you've ever been in an old farmhouse, like even before they were old farmhouses and they were just farmhouses.
Well, we wouldn't have been in them at that point.
Right, but like they're squeaky and, you know, like there's a lot of movement happening here. So the idea that all of these people slept through this is boggling, like mind-boggling to me.
They all must have had a lot to drink that night.
I don't know if they had a lot to drink. The kids? Yeah, really? They like must the 5-year-old was wasted?
Must have been.
Man.
Yeah. They gave that kid some Benadryl.
It's crazy. Seriously. It's like,
all right, 9:30, lights out. Here's some Benadryl.
It's crazy to me. So, in addition to being kind of in that odd crossways position on the bed, Lena was found with her nightgown pushed up over her waist and without any undergarments on. Now, having found this, it was believed that Lena was sexually assaulted either before or after she was killed. Now, I don't know that there was ever any evidence of actual physical sexual assault, but it's also believed that maybe it was more of a visual stimulation for
after the
killer, after the fact.
Death.
Exactly. All of the windows within the home had either drawn curtains or clothing hanging over it, as well as all of the mirrors in the home, which were covered by clothing or bed linens or something along those lines. But everything was covered, as well as the bodies. The bodies were also covered by either extra clothing or bed linens.
So my question is, why would the killer have done this? I mean, well, the mirrors and the windows are right. A way for, what is it, the souls will be trapped?
Yeah. I did a little digging, and I found out that covered mirrors, because that was really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I was kind of like, well, this is unique. It turns out that according to an article written by Claudia Christina for joincake.com, covering mirrors after death is a symbol in many cultures, especially popularized by Judaism, but dating back to Roman and Greek times, it's actually believed that as a soul is exiting the body, it can become ensnared or entrapped within the mirror, and instead of being able to move on to its final resting place, it just gets stuck there for eternity.
Okay, so now this guy, the killer,
right,
assuming it's a male, had so much rage,
right,
yet he's concerned with the soul being trapped.
Right.
That doesn't make sense to me.
It's very bizarre. It's also important to note, it can be found in Irish culture, Romanian culture, Polish culture. These are all people that would have been, like, you know, immigrants and then residents of Iowa at the mm-hmm. time. Definitely of European descent and everything. So whether it was someone passing through or someone who lived there and did this, it could have been, you know, a man of God or a woman of God, you know, something along those lines.
It's not like one of the first few commandments.
Thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not very godly.
No. I mean, it's nuts. And it's not just killing people, it's absolutely brutalizing their bodies.
Right.
Like, completely brutalizing their bodies.
But concerned about their after death.
Right. Their souls. Interesting. Very interesting. And it leads to a lot of speculation down the line, and it's really one of those things where there's probably so much evidence there, and DNA evidence and that kind of stuff that there was at the
right.
time.
Well, they didn't have the means to
exactly, but it was
process
useless.
Any of it.
It was totally useless. Right. So also found in the home after the bodies were discovered were two kerosene lamps. They were in the parlor where Lena and Ina had been sleeping and found dead. They had the wicks pulled back as if in an attempt to dim the lights. So I'm not very familiar with kerosene lamps, but I'm sure if you Google some images, you can get kind of a visual on that. But just imagine, you know, dimming the lights, obviously, so you're not seen as well. The ceilings above the bed, as I mentioned, showed marks from the axe as if the killer kind of wound up before striking the victim. So he or she were really putting their all into it.
Yeah.
I mean, they were really swinging hard. There was also a 2-pound slab pound of bacon found on the floor, which was wrapped in a cloth. There was another one in the icebox in the kitchen. There was a plate of food on the table and a pot of water with blood in it. And finally, part of a keychain on the floor near the bacon. So it's unfortunately been theorized that the bacon fat and the bacon slab wrapped in cloth was essentially used as like a modern day fleshlight.
That's disgusting.
I know. And it was used to masturbate the killer while looking and positioned to look at the partially nude corpse of Lena Stillinger. And that's why her nightgown had been pulled up.
super disturbing.
Super disgusting. Super disturbing. Absolutely. But that's kind of the unfortunate reality. And it also, I mean, you figure Lena and Ina Stillinger, they were not expected to even be there. Right. So if they were the targets, like, when did this person get in there, you know? And it also leans probably more toward it being a man, you know, as the killer instead of a woman.
I think so. It's definite at this point.
Right. Right.
I just didn't want to spoil that early on.
Mm, look at you. Okay. So after 10 p.m., the night of the murders, the coroner was allowed to remove the bodies from the scene. They were actually brought to a local fire department, as the regular town morgue couldn't handle that number of bodies at one time.
That's eight bodies it couldn't handle.
Exactly. As previously mentioned, the case is still unsolved. There have been so many suspects since 1912, as you can well imagine.
People are still wondering.
Right, right.
And theorizing, and absolutely. Everyone in that town, I'm sure, has their own.
Oh my God.
I mean, everyone knows about it, of course, but
absolutely.
I'm sure everyone has their idea of who done it.
Who done it, definitely. You know, one of the primary reasons for the unsolved nature of the case is the fact that after the bodies were discovered, there was no formal police department, as we mentioned. There was this peace officer. And so all of the townsfolk were like, well, I'm going to try and find a clue. So just imagine a modern-day crime scene where you just let an entire town of people trample through it. You're getting extra footprints. You're getting, you know, the killer himself could have been walking through the house and looking totally innocent, taking in everything that he'd done the night before, the morning before, and leaving behind.
If there was any extra evidence, it could have been taken.
Exactly. People stole souvenirs and took like little trinkets and stuff. That happens a lot.
I know. We had this conversation. What was it?
I don't even remember. Was it the...
It was, yeah.
Yeah, the Corpsewood Manor?
No, Lady...
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Why can't I think of her name?
In New Orleans.
Yep.
Yeah.
La Lori.
Exactly. People would go in and they'd take, because I feel like people at Corpsewood Manor took little weird trinkets and bricks and stuff like that too. Why would you want that in your house? It's such a negative energy.
But right.
Anyway. So with that, I mean, obviously it's being tampered with. One of the first suspects that would come up would be F.F. or Frank F. Jones. If you recall, he owned the rival store and was once the employer of J.B. Moore. He was actually also an Iowa State senator, so he had means.
Oh.
You know?
Fancy.
Exactly. A couple of kind of interesting things that I've stumbled across is, you know how people say, like, if you really dislike someone, like, you'll cross the street to avoid talking to them and stuff? F.F. Jones would actually do that. He would cross the street.
Well, let's remember back when we said that he not only left his employ, he stole the John Deere account.
Which was a huge account. But given that F.F. Jones kind of had his, you know, fingers in lots of jars.
I'm sorry, do you know any other tractor names? Because I just know John Deere.
I know, but like if it was a farm store, there could have been like feed companies and seed companies. And
either way, he took probably the biggest.
And he was a state senator. Right. He probably had an income from that.
Yeah,
no?
Well, I'd still be. I think it's more the.
The principal.
The principal, yeah.
I get it.
That's,
I mean,
rude.
I'd be pissed too, definitely. Yeah. So if you ever take my John Deere account, I swear to God, I'm coming for you.
Please don't leave holes in my ceiling.
I promise I won't, because I'll want the resale value on your condo.
Right, obviously.
I'll just want to have to remove the carpet.
Also, the ceilings are really tall.
Really tall. I'm definitely not that tall.
You'd have to throw the axe right up there.
Exactly.
And hope it comes down not on your head.
Way too much work for me. So, you know, when Moore left, he took a bunch of high-profile clients. It wasn't just the John Deere account, so it didn't sit well with Jones. There was also actually a rumor that J.B. Moore had an affair with Jones's daughter-in-law, so his son's wife. And so Frank and his son hired a killer named William Mansfield to kill the Moores. Now, in 1916, Mansfield was actually arrested, but he was found not guilty of the Moore murders. However, he was accused of many other axe murders in and around Iowa, including the murder of his own wife and child.
Wow.
Right? So, real stand-up guy.
Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, during the time of the Villisca axe murders, Mansfield had an alibi. He was in Illinois and was released on those charges.
Also, just because he had an axe with the other murders doesn't really
mean... Yeah, and you know what? I talk about that, too. And actually, I can bring it up now if you want. So, you kind of get to this point where you're, like, connecting all of these axe murders, and you're like, right. Well, they were all committed with an axe. Like, clearly the same guy did all of them, you know? And there are theories about that, which we'll definitely delve into. But think about, again, the time frame. These are rural farming. Rural farming communities. Everybody's got an axe. You use it like a tool, like a screwdriver. Like, if you open anybody's junk drawer, you're probably going to find a screwdriver. You're probably going to find scissors. Scissors.
I was going to say, I think I would liken it to
exactly.
axe to scissors.
Because it's a tool.
But also, you know, people aren't... let's call it a kitchen knife, because people aren't going around stabbing people with scissors.
I don't know.
I mean, I'm sure they are, but, like, more commonly...
A kitchen knife.
Would be a kitchen knife.
Exactly. And, you know, but all of these things are tools. And so, nowadays, you hear about people getting stabbed to death with something that they found in the home.
A kitchen knife.
Like a kitchen knife. Or scissors.
Or scissors.
Or a screwdriver. But that's because... We are not in a rural farming community where we have an axe propped up by our back door.
Right.
And we don't. We don't have an axe here. Which is weird, because we do chop wood.
What do you chop it with?
I mean, we have axes, but they're in the shed.
Okay.
Yeah, we have, like, an outside house where
the
axe...
A shed, you mean?
Yeah, but, and oddly enough, the axe is propped up next to the door of our shed, so...
Which is where it belongs.
Exactly.
Anyway.
So, anyway.
We digress.
Seriously. So Mansfield had an alibi. He was released. But then he turned around and sued the town of Villisca and the officer that accused him, because he felt like he was kind of unduly, you know,
well,
charged. And I'm like, you're still not a stand-up guy, Will.
You're still guilty.
I hate to break
just
it to
not
you.
Of that.
You did kill your own baby with an axe and were found guilty for it. But it's cool. So the next suspect who came along was a quirky, out-of-the-box, traveling preacher named George Kelly. He happened to be in town for the children's services, and he seemed like a possible suspect, especially since he left early the next morning, and according to witness accounts, he spoke about the murders on the train out of town before the bodies had even been located by Ross Moore. So it hadn't broken. The story hadn't broken yet, and he was already talking about it.
So he already knew about it,
exactly.
Somehow.
According to witness accounts. Now, those...
Again, we've discussed how...
How accurate witness accounts
right.
were, and those witness accounts were later recanted. So, whether or not it's accurate, who knows? There have been many reports that Kelly was also a peeping Tom, and had suffered from a complete mental breakdown in his youth. And I'm like, me too.
You're a peeping Tom?
Yeah. And mental breakdown.
Good
all
to
the
know.
Time. All day long. And I'm looking in your windows.
Creeper.
Okay, so Kelly actually admitted to the murders, but then he recanted his confession. So this guy's all over the map. Like, he's still having a mental breakdown. I get it.
As one does after murdering eight people.
Right. Oh my God, I didn't even think about it that way. Of course, then the eyewitness accounts also recanted their accounts of everything as well. So Kelly was released, and something that comes up and is important to note, Kelly was a very small man. He was only about 5'2", and a lot of people didn't feel that he could have swung the axe and hit the ceiling, since those markings were on the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, axe handles are long, and like...
Depending on the
axe.
It's
possible. It's totally possible.
I'm sorry, did no one... try this with a 5'2" person?
I don't know. I mean, like, I'm 5'4". Let's give it a go.
Well, we don't have a farmhouse to try it in.
Hmm.
I'm sure you can find one for us.
We can definitely find one.
Let's head up Woodbury.
Let's do it. And we'll just get some watermelons or something and put those in the bed, and we'll see what happens.
Oh, we're making this a full-blown fun experiment.
I mean, I say we go for it.
I'm in.
Breaking the Villisca Axe murders right now. can you imagine if we, like, if I found somebody who was selling their farmhouse in Woodbury and I'm like, hey, do you mind if we recreate an axe murder with some watermelons in one of your beds?
Please.
Thanks. Appreciate it. We digress. Something else to keep in mind too. So ceilings in an old farmhouse are usually, they're not open concept living spaces. Sorry, everybody. We just got interrupted by my child who was curious as to when dinner is.
Being super a important. Parent.
Absolutely. So Kelly was, I know what I was saying. We can't live in an antique home because Cole is too tall and would hit his head all the time. Now, J.B. Moore was about 6'2", which is very tall for the time, and yes, a good foot taller than George Kelly. Now, with that being said, the ceilings couldn't have been that low. I don't know. So I was trying to kind of rule out the old farmhouse, low ceilings, axe swing, but there are just so many factors that we don't have the details on.
Right, like we don't know actually. Axes. Yeah,
exactly.
The length of the axe and the height of the ceiling, exactly.
Right, exactly. Maybe J.B. Moore just spent his life ducking his head. Who knows? Anything's possible. If that's the way he wanted to live. I know, but it's his choice. It's his choice. We can't judge him for it. So
he can make his choice. That doesn't mean we won't judge.
So Kelly was tried twice, but both times he was found not guilty. One time it was a hung jury, and the other time he was just found not guilty. They didn't feel like there was enough evidence. The next person was actually a serial killer named Henry Lee Moore. Same last name, no relation to the Moore family. He was linked to the crimes. He was an active serial killer at the time, and it was believed that he may have committed them. It was sort of his style with the whole axe thing, but it was a false alarm. Nothing ever came of it. The townspeople at this point were suspecting anyone and everyone who was not from Villisca. So they were just like, you did it. I've never seen you before. You definitely killed those people.
Must be you.
It's been 10 years. You killed them. I'm sure of it. Even if you've never been here before. So, like we talked about as well, axes were just sort of a convenient weapon at the time, so it's hard to link any of that together. Into the 1930s, people came forward with false confessions, which were usually ruled out by incorrect details that usually come along with false confessions. Mm-hmm. Now, fast forward quite a bit to 1994. The Lynns purchased and restored the home to its original condition. And in 1998, the home was actually added to the historical registry as the true claim to Villisca, Iowa, and Villisca fame. In pop culture, the axe murders have inspired books, movies, and even a song by the group Strange Family, aptly named Villisca. It's incredibly somber. I listened to it.
Of course it did.
It's pretty good. I mean, you might like it. I don't know. Check it out. Again, that was Strange Family. Song is called Villisca. And there have been some really wild reports of supernatural activity in the home. So you can definitely actively tour the home today. I believe they do both a daytime and evening tour. Back in 2012, which was the 100th anniversary of the killings, there was actually a contest to win a night inside the home. Definitely not everyone feels that a profit should be made by someone, but this kind of stuff happens all the time. Like, profits get made by tragedies all the time.
It's true.
And considering that this is such a huge part of what the town is known for, I wouldn't be surprised if it's just like a disgruntled resident who's pissed that they didn't come up with it first, you know? I did try to pull up some details about the 1994 purchase and previous owners, but it was really almost impossible to find too much on it. However, for $155,500, you can buy a lovely old brick colonial, which is just about three blocks from the axe murder house. And for $7,500, which I will write a check for right now, you can purchase 1.13 acres in Villisca. On the other side of the 2-square-mile town, it's just a lot. You can build a home on it, slap yourself a nice little trailer, and take the tires off.
That's really cheap.
It's insanely cheap. Like, that's what I said. I was talking to Samantha, who's our newest Patreon, the other night at dinner, and I literally said, like, let's just go there. I'll just write them a check, and I'll just buy a piece of Villisca. Like, I'm like, come on.
But then also your home would be, if you, I assume you would build on this property.
A very would be tiny little hut.
Adjacent to...
It's on the opposite side of town.
Okay, the town's not that big. So, as I said, adjacent to the all the hauntings in this home.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. But maybe I could turn it into, like, a little Airbnb and people could stay there when they want to go to the Villisca Axe Murder
House. Good idea.
See? And then I will be profiting off of the tragedy, too. And I'm not even a resident.
Definitely okay. Be upset about that.
I know, right? So, as for third-party details on the home, I did find some stuff. It looks like it was actually rented to a couple in the 1930s, according to superparanormal.com. Homer and Bonnie Rittner. For some reason, that was a little trickier than I needed it to be. They were the tenants, and when they moved in, they had no knowledge of the home's history. One night, they actually saw an apparition of a man on their bed. They complained to neighbors and got the shock of a lifetime when they were told about the home's past, and they basically refused to ever sleep in the house again. And rightfully
understandable.
So. Exactly. Then, in the 1970s, the home was purchased by a bank. It became an investment rental property. Again, ongoing issues were had by tenants with paranormal happenings. One tenant was sharpening his knife, either in the act of or had just sharpened his knife, and then it mysteriously flew out of his hand and into his eye. It was at this point the bank then believed that the property was haunted.
At this point.
Once the knife went into a man's eye, they're like, there might be something up with this. And so that was the moment they chose. And, you know, it was definitely vacant for chunks of time as well. Now, according to America's Most Haunted, a TV show that's available on Discovery Plus.
You're welcome, by the
way. Yeah, exactly. Love it. There's heavy paranormal activity there, including children giggling and playing, doors opening and closing on their own. A visitor to the home actually once got locked into the attic space, and he was pounding on the door and shouting for his family. There was no visible lock on the door, but even though his family was just on the other side, they couldn't hear him. And
that's
then
creepy.
It just kind of magically opened up for him.
So
that's so terrifying
it
to
is.
Me.
And I actually watched also on Discovery Plus, what is it called? Ghost Adventures.
Oh, yeah.
I can't stand that show.
Oh, no, neither can I.
But Rachel watches
Zach,
it all the
Zach
time.
Zach something.
I don't know his name. The dark hair. Don't like him.
The worst.
I couldn't.
He's always, like, starting.
Within 2 minutes of watching the show, I texted Rachel. I was like, I don't know how you watch this. Garbage. Mm-hmm. It's literally just garbage. It's not that I don't believe in
Zach
that
Baggins.
Stuff.
Is it? Zach Baggins?
I have no idea.
Something like that.
It's not that
Y'all
I don't believe in any
about.
Of that, because right. I definitely do, but they're little gadgets. Like, they'll be like, oh, do you hear this? When I play it back for you, and it's just a sound, and then they'll, like, tell you what they think that it's saying, and it slightly sounds like that,
and
they're like, oh, my God,
it does sound like that.
Anyway, so they do an episode. It's in season 4, if you're interested, on the Villisca Axe Murder House.
Yeah.
And I was just, I couldn't actually get through it. I had to turn it off because I rolled my eyes every 2 seconds.
Oh, my God.
But if you're into that show, they do an episode on this house.
Yeah, I never got into them. There was another ghost show that I really liked for a while, and they were more tolerable. His personality is so abrasive to me. Like, I can't stand watching him.
Yeah.
You know, so the current owner, the Lynns, or owners, they've definitely stated that a lot of people go into the house as non-believers, mm-hmm. and then they come out just, like, scared to bits, like, totally terrified. All right, so that is the tale of the Villisca Axe Murders, and actually, if you're hungry for more information, because there is a lot of stuff out there, because it's just such an ongoing...
And everyone in the town has their own opinion.
Absolutely.
And there's, like, 5 books written about it.
Oh, my God, yeah. And one of the books that I'm actually sort of... I haven't read it, but I'm familiar with it. I remember listening to this, and the other podcast, if I'm not mistaken, that I listened to on this, used the book for a lot of information. And it's basically a father-daughter team, Bill James and Rachel McCarthy James. And, you know, the book was published in 2017. It's called The Man from the Train. And it really dives super deep into all of this and sort of spells out who Bill James, the father, believes was responsible.
Was it Kelly? I would assume if he's the man from the train.
I don't know because I haven't read the book, but I actually think it's not a person who's been mentioned that we talked about. So it's definitely something that you should check out if you want to know more. It's a wild story. I mean, it really is. So highly recommend that. And yeah,
that's it for today.
That's all we got. We'll be back next week with John Chocolos.
Yes.
Chocolos. Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't really know.
We'll figure out how to say his name by then.
Somewhere between now and then. So that should be interesting. And again, listen in. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you at CT Horror Fest, and we will talk to you between now and then.
Hey.
Bye.
You should press stop.